Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all those providing to the needs of veterans through the VA Healthcare Network, and especially the Ann Arbor VA Healthcare System, and they're receiving the Plaintree Silver Merit Recognition for excellence in patient-centered care.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yeah, well, I think we've got all that. Dale, hey, well, welcome this morning. You know what? I think everything's frozen. Boy, oh boy. What did Maria, you said it was what, minus 9 Celsius, whatever the heck that is. Why can't they do it like we do it, right? Minus 9 Celsius. But we're here, right? Anyway, we've got quite a program here today, folks. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and just very quickly, Dale, and I know that you were commenting on this, is the fact that the Ann Arbor VA won that Plaintree Silver Merit Award. This is the first time that has been awarded since the whole program started on veteran-centered care. I know that you have a few comments on that.
Well, my only comment really is that we're so fortunate to have the VA system and that we have here in Ann Arbor, because it's the care is excellent, the people are excellent, they seem to be very caring. Everybody that I've talked to that goes through the VA system has had a pretty good experience up there, and you know, we don't have to wait months, it seems like, where they do at some other facilities. So we're very fortunate to have them here. I'm very grateful.
It's called VISN, Vet Integrated Service Network. Boy, there's a real one of
them. Okay, gotcha.
Vet Integrated. Who thinks of these things? But anyway, it's all about patient focused delivery, patient centered care. Everything starts at the VA system. And the first thing you do is go to the VA and what?
Register.
Everybody hear that out there? Register. Got it? You got to go to the VA, get it started. Everything starts from there. And boy, oh boy, they have animal therapy. They have wilderness therapy to where you can go out with them and camp and all that. Whoa! All that's available through the VA. Of course, mental health and as well as medical care.
I think the other thing, Bob, is that we're so fortunate to have the University of Michigan Medical Center right nearby, and many of the interns and residents, you know, do their circuit through the VA hospital. And I know through your personal experience that you had some major surgery that was done through University of Michigan Hospital.
Well, a lot of folks don't know that secondary and tertiary care has to be, is provided in this particular case by the University of Michigan. Being a public hospital, they have to provide so many hours per year, because it's public supported, for outgoing outreach into in this particular case in the VA system. So for secondary and tertiary care, I had a board certified neurologist do my surgery. I mean, Hello, is that doesn't get any better now? The guy did thousands of these, and it's been 12 months. 14. Boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Yes, we should have a rim shot on that.
I don't have a rim shot here.
Boom. Yeah.
There you go.
So I feel, and then speaking of, they call this a segue, folks, in the business. We talk about veteran. Hey, here we go. Veteran to veteran care. I have with me on the line Scott Faber. He's a veteran of the U.S. Army, served in Operation Enduring Freedom. He was in Afghanistan in 2012. He began Suits for Soldiers, and that's changing the lives of veterans and their families. Scott, welcome to Veterans Radio.
How you doing, Bob and Dale?
Oh, well, we're doing real good, trying to stay warm. Scott, how did all this start?
It all started over an article I read while I was in Afghanistan in 2012 about a soldier who didn't get a job because he didn't have the proper attire. Somebody else got the job who had a lower GPA, worse education, and just because of his appearance, he didn't get a job. So, boom, it started.
What are some of the services that you provide for veterans at Suits for Soldiers?
We offer everything from like resume writing to job placement. We help them get their VA loans and other benefits situated. We offer mentoring. Coming this year, we're also going to be offering counseling services and trying to add additional services once we finalize our building.
Now, I'm reading here in some of the notes that you sent me, 1,000 suits were donated. Where in the world did you find 1,000 suits?
Actually, we have like probably four to five thousand suits laying around right now. People are donating by the hundreds every week, and last month we gave away 1,000. Next week at the VA hospital, or next month on February 10th at the VA hospital in Detroit, I'm hoping to give away 2,000 pieces of business attire.
Well, I hope you give us an invitation to that. That's really very, very cool. So you not only can get suits, you can get shirts and ties and maybe even a little counseling on how you present yourself when you're being interviewed. Is that correct?
Exactly. We try to make sure that they're either ready for the workforce or education, either one, but they got to look good and be ready for that initial interview.
Now, in the last 120 days, and I know, what is that, 3 months? No, 4 months, there you go, 60 people were hired, and they went through your program. Just very quickly, brief on that.
Yes, in the last few months of 2013, it was a big push meeting with companies to actually hire veterans, not just say they're going to hire them, but I met one-on-one with mostly executives. I kind of skipped over the HR department, went to the executives of companies and asked them, hire veterans and, you know, stop talking about it, stop advertising, just do it. And they did. A little over 60 people have been hired so far through efforts like that.
Oh, congratulations. I think that is fantastic. Now,
thank you.
Thank you, too, for doing all this. And remember, folks, Scott is a veteran. This is a case of veterans helping veterans. What do you see in the future and short term?
In the future, we see getting a permanent location where we can help veterans 7 days a week, not just Monday through Friday like a lot of the organizations out there. We want to offer 7 days a week help, everything from resume writing to job placement to if they just need to talk or pick up suits, just something where they can come in and feel comfortable and make a change in their lives for the best.
Okay, give us the website.
www.suitsforsoldiers.org.
And a phone number, a little slow so that everybody, right? You should always have a pencil and pen when you're listening to Veterans Radio because you never know what's going to come across. Go ahead, Scott. Give us the phone number.
Phone number is 248-757-8829.
One more time.
248-757-8829, and that's 7 days a week.
And that's Suits for Soldiers, folks. Well, we want to thank you very much. Oh, Dale, do you have something?
I just had a question. Maybe I wasn't paying attention. I couldn't find my pencil. Where are you located?
We're actually in Metamora now, but we're looking to find a permanent building around the 75-696 interchange to make it easy for people to get to us.
Where in the devil is Metamora?
You said Metamora. I thought that was in California or Colorado or something. Where?
Metamora is like north of Lake Orion in Oxford. It's Little House on the Prairie.
Okay.
To the folks in Arizona. That should clear everything up.
I didn't know we were
Suits for. Well, that just shows you the wide expanse that we have, Dale, and all the folks that we reach. Our universe, as they say in the business, is very.
I have another question. Oh, do you have social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything like that?
Yes, we have it all. It's facebook.com/suitsforsoldiers.
Okay.
And Twitter is @suitsforsoldier, no S.
And once again, folks, 248-757-8829. Give these folks a call. Hey, if you're not sure, give them a call anyway, because I'm sure that they'll be able to help you. If you know somebody in your family, give out that phone number. Scott, we want you to come back. Please come back where we can go a little more into detail. Would you do that?
I would love to. I'd love to talk to you again.
Well, thank you from all of us here at WDO and Veterans Radio, and you have a blessed day.
You guys as well.
Woo! Boy, Dale.
That's a cool thing.
Isn't that cool?
I love that idea.
You know, somebody took it upon... Do it, right? do something. And this is another case of veterans helping veterans. We talked about that transition a couple of weeks ago, and I know that that's a real universal subject matter. And to see that this is happening, you know, and I found this. How this came to me was a veteran gave me the brochure. So that's how we are. And by the way, folks, if you do have something for Veterans Radio,
let us know. Send us an email. We also are on social media. We're on Facebook at Veterans Radio, and we're on Twitter also, so you can get a hold of us. You can also go to our website, veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, let us know the information, or if you want to send Bob or myself an email, just send it to Bob at veteransradio.net or Dale at veteransradio.net. I'm just thinking about, you know, we keep talking about when you're in the service that somebody's always got your back. And I love this concept of these guys with the suits for veterans that even when they get out, they're looking out for their buddies. And I'm just so grateful that they're able to do that. And that sounds like a great organization. And I was thinking while he was talking about when I got out of the service, I didn't own a suit. Why would I have a suit? You know, I went right from college right into the military. The only suit I had was were dress blues. And I wore those once. So that wouldn't go well, I guess, if you're looking
still
for
have
a job.
Do you still have them?
Oh, no.
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 Goodwill or badwill or whatever. Okay, folks, we'll be right back right after this very important message with our author, Jack Cheevers, author of the book, Act of War. Stay tuned.
States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now, we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on our home base station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX in Saginaw Bay City, Michigan, and WDEO FM in Naples, Florida.
We're back here on Veterans Radio, and now I'll introduce my first guest, Jack Cheevers, author, former Los Angeles Times reporter, University of California, Berkeley graduate, writer, authorian, and historian. They're authorian. Yeah, I know. It's cold out, man. And here we are. A big welcome for Jack Cheevers. Yeah, we had all kinds of fanfare ready for you, Jack. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks very much, Bob.
How did this all get started? Writing a book, Act of War, the story of the Pueblo incident. How did you get started with all this?
Well, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. This goes all the way back to 1999, and I was just looking for something to write a book about. I've always wanted to write a book since I was a kid. And I happened to wander into a coffee shop near my house one day, and they sold books on the side, used books, and I looked them over, and I saw a very dog-eared memoir by the captain of the Pueblo, Lloyd Bucher, known mostly by his nickname Pete. And I remembered it a little bit. I remember a little bit about the Pueblo incidents. I was just a kid then, but I remembered enough about it to pick up the book and pay my dollar. And I took it home, and I started reading it, and I thought I would just read a couple of pages that weekend and do some other things. And I wound up just sitting down. I literally couldn't put it down the whole weekend. I just found the story absolutely fascinating. And I realized that nothing had been written about the Pueblo in quite a while. And so I called up the captain, just cold called him. He was then living down in San Diego. not too far from me, and told them who I was, and eventually started driving down there on weekends to interview them, and the whole project grew out of those interviews.
Now, when you were looking for information from the government and from official papers, has the fog of secrecy been lifted?
Well, you know, the military classifies everything, and it also has records on everything, which is why military topics are good to write about if you can get the material declassified. There was a tremendous amount of reporting, you know, and so forth, written done by the various government agencies on the Pueblo, and unfortunately, a certain amount of it is still classified. I managed to get about 10 or 11,000 pages declassified, but believe it or not, there is still more.
Now, on the 5th of January 1968, the Pueblo left Yokosuka, Japan, headed for the Sea of Japan and destiny. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that departure?
Well, the Pueblo was by itself. It was an old army cargo ship that had been converted into an electronic surveillance vessel. It had a crew of 83, which was much larger than the original freighter crew. And it was January, as you mentioned, so it was winter, very cold and snowy in the Sea of Japan. And the ship's mission was to go across to North Korea and then basically cruise the coast of North Korea all the way up to the Soviet border and come back down south and pick up whatever information it could on military radar and radio stations along the way. And then when it reached the southern point of its journey, to come back to Japan, come across the Sea of Japan again, and take photographs of whatever Soviet warships it encountered along the way. And the crew, one of the elements of their orders was to also look for several submarines that the North Koreans were believed to be operating. There were Russian-built subs. There were only four of them. But the Navy particularly wanted photographs and information on those subs.
Now, when I look at photos of the Pueblo, this ship looks unseaworthy. The shine, that's a distance, folks, from the waterline to the top of the deck, is so narrow, I would think that any kind of blow is going to knock this thing over with all that top heavy of surveillance equipment. Wow, tell us about that.
Well, it was a pretty small ship by Navy standards. It was only 176 feet long. It was smaller than some ocean-going Navy tugboats. And one of the ensigns that I write about in the book, Skip Schumacher, was kind of shocked when he first saw the ship because the gangway actually led down to the ship instead of up, which was what he was used to on other Navy vessels. So it was a pretty small ship. It rowed very roughly. It took quite a beating on the way over, but it was capable of you know, it was seaworthy. It was capable of long ocean journeys. It was just a small ship.
So here it was laden with all this equipment, electronics equipment, photograph equipment, pizza ovens, whatever else that they could cram. How many crew did they have?
They had a total of 83 men.
83 plus the captain, or is that 83 with the captain?
That's with the captain.
Okay, so it's known colloquially known as a spy ship. Was that true?
Yes, it was. It was stuffed to the gunnels with that kind of equipment. It had code machines. It had equipment for receiving electronic signals, for scanning the coast, as I mentioned, for radar and radio signals, recording those signals, analyzing them, and then they'd be transmitted back to the Navy and the National Security Agency for analysis. And the reason they were trying to get information on those coastal installations is that in the event of war with North Korea, which is always a possibility, unfortunately, they wanted to know exactly where those facilities were located so that they could be attacked by aircraft or warships. They also wanted to know, the size of the radar signals so that they could potentially jam the signals if we went to war with North Korea.
Now, on the 22nd of January, by the way, folks, this is 1968, right? 22nd of January. They were not. Something happened. The North Koreans had an assassination unit, and what was that all about?
Well, this is quite extraordinary. This is back in the time of Kim Il-sung when he was the leader of North Korea. He's the grandfather of the current leader, and his dream was to take over South Korea and to reunify the Korean Peninsula under communist rule. So he had a plan to assassinate the president of South Korea, Park Chung-hee, in 1968. And there were 31 commandos from North Korea who were all young men. They were all in their 20s. They were all very highly trained. They'd spent months running with sand sewn into their trouser cuffs to strengthen their leg muscles. They had 60-pound packs on their backs. They had submachine guns. They had automatic pistols. They had grenades. They were armed to the teeth. Everybody knew judo and jiu-jitsu, so they could fight with their bare hands and feet. And their mission was to, believe it or not, sneak into Seoul, the capital of South Korea, make their way into the Blue House, which is the South Korean presidential residence, and murder President Park, actually decapitate him, murder his entire family. His daughter, by the way, is now president of South Korea. She was just a kid at the time. And then steal vehicles from the motor pool and head back north. That was actually the plan. And these guys managed to get within 1,000 yards of the Blue House. They infiltrated through the demilitarized zone. They traveled at night. It was, January is very wintry. It was snowing. They slept during the day to conceal themselves and traveled at night. They were moving very fast, and they wound up in downtown Seoul on a Sunday night at about 10 o'clock. And they decided to, basically travel in plain sight. So they were disguised as South Korean soldiers, and they were literally marching down the street in a column toward the Blue House when they were finally challenged by a South Korean cop. And he asked them for their credentials, and they claimed that they were South Korean soldiers coming back from an anti-guerrilla mission in the mountains nearby, and they kept going. They just basically brushed past this guy and kept going toward the Blue House. And he was a little suspicious, so he called his superior. Superior came out in a Jeep. He again stopped these guys, and at that point they lost it, and they started shooting and throwing hand grenades around. They blew up a city bus. They killed a 16-year-old boy who was on his way home from the library that night, and they scattered in all directions. There were 31 of them, and of course the South Korean army, U.S. troops, South Korean combat police, all were frantically looking for these guys and started to hunt them down one by one, and eventually killed all but two of them, who are believed to actually have made it home. They captured one. They actually captured two, but one of them blew himself up with a hand grenade in police custody, and the other guy was placed before a press conference where all this information came out. So this happened exactly less than two days before the Pueblo arrived off the port of Wonsan, which is a very heavily militarized port on the east coast of North Korea. There's a very large MiG base there. At that time, there was a very large MiG jet base there. There was a North Korean Navy base there. But unfortunately, nobody told the Pueblo what had happened. And North and South Korea both put their armed forces on maximum alert. A lot of people thought war would break out at any minute. People in Seoul were actually hoarding rice because they thought war was imminent. That happened to be the exact moment when the Pueblo arrived off this North Korean port. But nobody had warned the captain, in some subsequent investigations, that was one of the problems that people talked about. Why hadn't the Navy you know, at least warned the captain, or better still, pulled the ship back until the international tensions calmed down.
Now, folks, think of this, folks. Here are these sailors on an American ship. They're going. I mean, they definitely don't look like a naval armed whatever. I mean, they've got all this electronic equipment. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure out what all this is. They have a spy ship. They're on international waters, and well, nobody told the captain that there was tension going, and didn't the South Korean president Park Chung-hee he went ape, right?
Yes, he was very upset and very rattled, very angry. He was terrified that his beloved only son might have been killed in this attack. He was drinking heavily, according to U.S. diplomats. He was sleeping with a loaded rifle in his bedroom. He was frantically building additional defenses around the Blue House and in downtown Seoul, putting up barbed wire, building pillboxes. He was so angry that he was throwing ashtrays and other objects at his wife and his staff. He was very, very upset. He was an ex-military man himself. He was a former general who had taken power in a coup in 1961. And he was just, in the words of one U.S. diplomat, he was hungering to close with Kim Il-sung. I mean, he was so angry. He just wanted, the one thing he wanted to do was retaliate, to lash back at the North. A lot of his generals were advising him to do exactly that. Let's go north and get this guy. And we'll take over the North.
Now, folks, if you have a question for our guest, please call us at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. We're talking with Jack Cheevers, author of Act of War, an excellent book about the USS Pueblo, the incident of the Pueblo. And, well, you know, folks, we just don't know a whole lot about this. But now take us back, Jack, to the 23rd of January. The Pueblo is being... they're being shadowed, they're being approached, wasn't there even an aircraft carrier or a sub? Or tell us about that, Jack.
No, they were all alone. During this period of time, the Navy operated these little spy ships with no protective cover from there's no destroyer over the horizon, there was no aircraft carrier over the horizon, there was no combat jets in the air. They were out there by themselves, and that had worked very well with the Soviets. The Soviets had their own fleet of fishing trawlers. These were ships that were loaded with electronic surveillance gear, but they were actually fishing trawlers too, and they were watching U.S. Navy vessels all around the world. And the Navy actually commissioned its own little fleet of spy ships in response to what the Soviets were doing. But there had always been a gentleman's, sort of an unspoken gentleman's agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union. Basically, you don't touch our ships and we won't touch yours. And the Soviets harassed our ships quite a bit. They tried to push them back from the coast as far as possible, because you had to be close in to receive these radio and radar signals. But the North Koreans didn't play by those rules, as we found out.
Okay, so now Booker says, hey, I'm being harassed. Did he tell the big shots all about this? And what else did he do with the American flag?
Well, as he was coming south along the North Korean coast, he realized that the North Korean radar had locked on his ship. He knew they were tracking him. And the day before the attack, there were a couple of North Korean trawlers who actually came very close to him and looked him all over and photographed his ship. And as you mentioned, on the 23rd of January, he was actually attacked. He was about 15 miles offshore, which was well into international waters. They were still trying to pick up signals from the coast. Booker was actually having lunch at the time and got a call from Ms. Bridge saying that a North Korean submarine chaser was approaching. These were vessels that had 57-millimeter cannon and machine guns aboard. The Pueblo was armed with only two 50-caliber machine guns and a handful of 45 pistols and some 30-odd six rifles. It was barely armed at all. And the subchaser was followed pretty quickly by three North Korean torpedo boats. And they ran up some signal flags, ordering Bucher to heave to stop his ship. He was already stopped, so he was confused by the flags. And then they started circling him, and eventually they ordered him to follow them into the port of Wonsan, and he refused to do that. And he realized there's no way he could slug it out with the North Koreans. In the meantime, a couple other ships had shown up. So now he was facing six of these vessels, their gunboats, as well as two MiG fighters overhead who had already fired a couple missiles. He tried to run. He thought that was the only option, the only realistic option open to him. So he basically headed directly east out toward the open sea, and the North Koreans started opening fire. They opened fire on him and started shooting up his ship pretty badly.
Well, here it is, folks. You have a crew to protect. You have a job to do. You're the captain. And by the way, the only armament they had was one 50-caliber machine gun, and it was stored below deck, and it should be. I mean, right, you know, come on. This was a surveillance ship. So here it is, the moment of truth. The moment that we've been waiting for to hear what was on the captain's mind.
Well, like you say, I mean, he faced a very difficult dilemma at that point. You know, the Navy's orders to its, you know, the Navy tradition for 200 years was, you know, don't give up the ship. But his specific orders were to not provoke the North Koreans. His commanding officer, his operational commander in Japan, Admiral Frank Johnson, had specifically told him, don't start a war out there, Captain. He had literally used those words as Bucher was departing from Japan, and he was ordered not to give the North Koreans any pretext to create an international incident. The machine guns, or two of them, had been put on at the last minute in Japan. Before this, these ships had been unarmed, and the thinking was within the Navy that, you know, they're not combat ships, so don't put any weapons on them. Don't provoke the North Koreans, because basically, you know, the only combat the Pueblo is capable of engaging in was maybe, you know, fending off an armed junk or, you know, a fairly small vessel. It was completely unsuited for any real combat at sea. It was unable to defend itself in that way. So Bucher's dilemma is, slug it out and get X number of your men killed, or run and buy time and try to destroy as much of the classified equipment on board as possible. And as I say, he was under fire from 57 caliber millimeter cannon, as well as machine gun fire from the what turned out to be now four torpedo boats. There were MiG jets overhead who were clearly armed. He was close to a big MiG base, a big Navy base. He didn't have a lot of options. One of his men had his leg basically blown off by a cannon shell. 10 others were wounded. Bucher himself was wounded, had been hit by shrapnel on the bridge. He was in a very, very difficult situation, and he chose to stop his ship and surrender. And he later explained publicly that he felt that he was completely outgunned, completely surrounded, and it would have been futile to fight back, that his men just would have been slaughtered, and he didn't see any point in getting them slaughtered.
Now, while all this is going on, they're destroying equipment. I would think that you'd be able to, I mean, what, crowbar, baseball bat, I mean, whatever you could do. And as far as the documents, I often wondered, could they have been put in a mailbag with a weight and thrown into the Sea of Japan? I mean, what is that, 5,000 feet down below? How are they going to get that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, they were, like we've said, the ship was stuffed with equipment and classified paper. There was an entire detachment on the ship called the Special Operations Department that was filled with electronic equipment. There was about 800 pounds of classified documents. Those were things like operating manuals for the code machines. There were literally thousands of top secret messages that had come in as part of the Navy fleet broadcast system. Those contained all kinds of intelligence reports on U.S. eavesdropping on the North Vietnamese air defense system. Now, this was an incredible intelligence prize for the North Koreans to capture. The men had there was no efficient or quick means for getting rid of this stuff. The men had been issued fire axes and sledgehammers to get rid of the hardware, and they were told to get rid of the paper, as you mentioned, by putting it in weighted bags and dumping it over the side. They had a couple of shredders that were very, very slow. And had very small capacity. literally, these shredders were so small, you'd have to take one of these bound manuals and break it up and feed it page by page into the shredder. They had a couple of very small incinerators. The Navy had refused to buy Bucher a fuel-fed incinerator, as he had requested. So he actually went out and spent money from the Cruise Recreation Fund to buy a commercial incinerator, but it was very small, very low capacity, and there was just way too much of this stuff to get rid of. He had, in Japan, started to grasp the size of this problem of disposing of the stuff in an emergency, and actually went around Japan, where he had been stationed a couple years earlier as a submarine officer, and asking everybody, well, do you have any dynamite that I can use? You figure, well, at least I'll blow up the ship and send it to the bottom quickly. They were, you were asking about the water depth. They were actually in not shallow water, but not super deep water. It was about 180 feet, which is a deep dive, but a diver, can reach that depth. And, in fact, the North Koreans did send divers down, and they did recover some of the material that was thrown overboard.
Jack, we had a call on the line. Alvin, P-L-U-C-K-A-E, Pluck. Alvin, call us back, 877-573-7825. Please, we had a Pueblo crewman call us. I was just waiting for the right opportunity to get him to comment on that. And we lost him. We lost the contact. Alvin, please call us back, 877-573-7825. Alvin Pluck. Does that name sound familiar?
Yes, it's actually Alvin Plucker, and I've been emailing him back and forth in the last few days.
Oh, okay. Wow. Oh, there we go. Alvin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, that's me. I'm sorry about that. Something come up.
Oh, well, all right. Here we are. Here's that day. Chaos is going on. What was going through your mind, Alvin?
Well, first of all, I'd already had quite a bit of training. My name is Alvin Plucker, Plucker as in Plucker, So anyway, I know Jack and we've been in correspondence here a little bit. And I had three tours in Vietnam on the USS Hornet before I came to Pueblo. And the strange thing about the Pueblo is I had like 2 months left of my 4-year enlistment. And I had a lot of friends in navigation department. I was a quartermaster. And the captain of the USS Hornet says, yeah, you really don't want to go to the Pueblo, do you? He says, you only got 2 months left. And he says, I said, no. And he says, well, I'll see if I can get you to stay here on board. And so he called BUPERS, and Bureau of Personnel, and they denied that he said all of the men for the USS Pueblo were hand-selected, and I would have to go even if it was only for 2 months.
Well,
so,
Alvin, take us back to that day. Here's things going on. You probably were having in your bunk, whatever, writing a letter home. You were doing something, and all of a sudden all of this is coming about. What was going through your mind at that moment?
Well, you know, we weren't expecting such a type of a seizure or even an approach, you know. We were figuring that we were basically an unarmed vessel, even though we had 10 machine guns and 50 calibers, but we weren't really under orders to have to use them, that we shouldn't have needed them, and that we were assured that we would be forever protected should we run into some kind of a crisis. So we were very surprised that we were actually approached. I was on duty and just went off duty just before the actual commencement of the firing went on, and I was in charge of the logs and the charts and all this stuff. And
were you throwing stuff away, burning it?
No, I didn't do that. I had to man a phone jack system to stay in communication just in case the bridge was taken out so I could switch to aft steering. Because we'd had to control, we could have controlled the ship from aft steering, which is down in the engine room, if they should happen to take the entire bridge section out.
Okay, Alvin, stay on the line with us. Okay, Jack.
Okay.
Jack, let's go back to, all right, here they are. There's not going to be any U.S. response as far as jets, whatever, and we can get into that in just a moment. But here they are, and now they're being towed into Wonsan Harbor, and the men are all bound and blindfolded, and terror is going through everybody's mind. What's going on here? So now what happens? Tell us about that.
Well, they, as you pointed out, they were boarded by the North Koreans, and the ship was ordered to follow these gunboats into Wonsan, and nobody in the crew had any idea what to expect, what was happening.
Yep.
And they were brought into the port, and as you mentioned, they were bound and they were blindfolded and they were taken off the ship. And the North Koreans immediately, well, they actually started while they're on the ship, beating people and firing AK-47s over their heads and just trying to terrorize them as much as possible. And from Wonsan, they were transferred, they were taken into Pyongyang first, and then they were sent out to some type of military facility where they were basically imprisoned.
Okay, how did you feel, Alvin, when the blindfold was taken off and you met the North Koreans? There they are. Were they happy, friendly, smiling, frowning, throwing things at you? What was all that about?
Well, very little of the above. I'll tell you one thing: they weren't happy with us. Certainly, they hated Americans, and I've never seen a race ever that could have that much hatred in your hearts. Of course, they were three generations of hatred, you know. And when they first come aboard, the first thing they do is start kicking you around and knocking you around
While you were bound, right?
Oh.
you couldn't even defend yourself.
No, they bound us up, took us up on the out there in the frozen deck and threw us down in groups and we froze there for a while we're on our way in, yes. And that was the most cold that I've ever experienced. I still suffer from a lot of that to this day because our hands were actually pretty well froze, you know. But they were pretty brutal people. It's quite an undertaking to know that that you could allow people to do this to you and you couldn't fight them back. That's the worst thing is why didn't they unleash us, let us go, you know? I mean, I would have loved to have grabbed a 50 caliber or a Thompson submachine gun, but that wasn't in our stars.
Jack, okay, here we are. All right, this is going on. The Pueblo now is being secured in Wonsan Harbor. The men, the crew is being interned in a POW camp. Things are happening very quickly. Tell us about all that. Tell us about the interrogation, the torture, etc.
Well, the North Koreans were they wanted to use the crewmen as propaganda pawns. So their goal was to break them down physically and psychologically as quickly as possible. And they concentrated on the captain. And he was subjected to just a phenomenal amount of terror, physical beatings. He was kicked. He was hit with rifle butts. He was just knocked around incredibly. At one point, they subjected him to a mock execution. They forced him down to his knees. They told him that he had 2 minutes to sign a false confession that the ship had been inside North Korean waters and had been conducting espionage, which is something it wasn't doing. It was conducting a military mission. And then they pulled the trigger. But he was still alive. They told him, "Oh, it's a mistake. It was a dud. You got another 2 minutes." They did it to him again. At one point, they took him into a dungeon where there was a man who was strapped to the wall. He had just been horribly tortured. He looked like he was barely alive. He was foaming at the mouth. His arm had been broken. One of his eyes looked like it had basically been knocked halfway out of the socket. Booker was horrified. He thought at first that it was one of his men, but the North Koreans said, no, this is a captured spy. This is a South Korean, and this is what we do to spies, so you better confess, you son of a bitch. They worked him over, and this is in the course of 24 hours. And the thing that finally broke him was they sat him down in a room and they said, "Okay, you've resisted so far." He refused several times to sign this confession, and each time they would beat him. They beat him unconscious at one point, or they would do something else to him. But he refused several times during the course of this horrifying 24 hours to sign the confession. The thing that finally broke him was they sat him down and said, "Okay, you've resisted so far, and what we're going to do now is we're going to bring your men in one by one, and we're going to blow their heads off right in front of you. And we're going to start with the youngest member of the crew, who's this 19-year-old seaman named Howard Bland, who's since passed away." And Booker turned his head, and there was Seaman Bland standing outside the door. And, his mind is racing. Do I gamble with this guy's life? Do I try to hold out? This phony confession is filled with obvious lies. It sounds like it wasn't even written by a native English speaker. What should I do? And he decided that the Koreans might well be serious about killing his crew, so he signed this phony confession.
Alvin, I have to ask this question. We have about 12 minutes, so time's going by very quickly. But I do want to ask this question. We saw the famous photo, and that was your way of resisting and telling the world what was really going on here. And that was the Hawaiian salute. Whose idea was that, Alvin?
Well, I think originally Chief Goldman's idea. I think he took the severest beating for it having shown, because I think after interrogating the crew to find out exactly who initiated it, I think it was pretty much him that had originally given the thought out, and that Booker followed up on it and thought it was a great idea. Got to remember that there was communications between rooms, and by one method or another, or by one seaman or another.
How did you do that?
Well, there was a seaman that was in charge of cleaning Commander Booker's room. He was the only one in his room, and so Commander Booker would relay what he wanted the crewman to follow or to do, or like the code of conduct and several other different things, and so he would tell him, and then this crewman would go from room to room repeating it, and we would learn that way, especially when it comes to signing confessions. The Hawaiian good luck sign was only one way of, and that was in photos, portraying the fact that we said this is all BS. But what we really did was a lot of our confession letter writing and stuff. We had all kinds of sayings and and that we would put in there that, like Barney Google and different ones, so help me, Hannah, you know, I'd never do this again to the North Koreans and all this stuff. And everything went into these letters, and we sent them to false people. I come from a little town of about 50-some people. We never, ever had a mayor in that town, but I had a mayor. And I would write my letters of confession to this mayor.
I do want to take a moment here, just very quickly, that how brave all of you were, how brave you were, and what an example of bravery and the military code of honor. You followed that. You were so brave, and you kept resisting, and you kept fighting. Boy, wow, that's really hard. How about you, Dale? Yeah, he's shaking his head. Absolutely. Jack Cheevers, author of Act of War. Let's go back. Alvin, we'll get back to you in a second. Jack,
okay.
All right, here's what's going on. President Johnson is having barbecue. He just got awoken or what, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff or what are tripping over their brass buttons and falling all over the place. Nobody knows what to do. They're thinking there's going to be a nuclear war. We're going to set an atomic bomb. Ow, tell us about that.
Well, I'm sure your listeners will recall 1968 was pretty much the height of the Vietnam War, and Johnson was very, and all his advisors were very preoccupied with Vietnam. And the last thing that they wanted was a second war in Asia. So they decided pretty quickly that they were going to try to resolve the public crisis by diplomatic means. They were worried that they needed to reinforce South Korea, and there was a huge military buildup. There were more than 350 American combat aircraft were sent, were transferred from various bases either to South Korea or Japan. There was an armada of 25 warships that was moved into the Sea of Japan, included the USS Enterprise and two other carriers. So it was a huge buildup of force that was hopefully was going to prevent the North Koreans from attacking the South and possibly intimidate the North Koreans into giving back the ship. But the orders went out to all the air and sea units to stand by, to not take action, because we're going to try to resolve this thing peacefully. And Johnson and his team then started negotiating with the North Koreans in secret at a small village called Panmunjom, which is where the Korean War armistice was signed. And that process took 11 very long months.
Now, Alvin, as the weeks and months were going by and the torture was intense, did you feel that we abandoned you?
Yes, I did. Well, actually, we was expecting the United States to come in within the first few days. We figured that we were all going to die, that we were going to do our best to try to break out of prison, you know, when that time came.
So the Marines were going to come, right?
Yeah, we can't figure out. We never could figure out why the U.S. would not come in to rescue it.
How did you keep your morale up? And by the way, folks, this is going on. How did you keep your morale up?
Well, we were a group of brothers, and we looked after one another. We sympathized with one another. We prayed a lot. If you weren't religious, you become, you know, you believed in anything that was higher up than the United States. We were so scared, all of us, to go back home. I don't know if we were certainly more scared of the Koreans and what they'd do to us, but we were scared to go back to the United States knowing if what they were going to do to us. We had surrendered the ship. We had broke the code of conduct. We had allowed classified materials to fall into the hands of the enemy. I mean, that's Leavenworth, you know, so...
Well, I don't think that is the case. I know, like I said earlier, we all give you a big salute. How brave were you and your fellow crewmen were. Jack, okay, we've got 5 minutes to go to the end of the program. Time's going by fast. So now, all right, 11 months goes by. Everybody's forgotten about it. Well, it's 1969. There's an election and all that business in Chicago. And so here we are. Take us to that point. 11 months. So how did the crew get released?
Well, the North Koreans from day one had only one demand, which is that the United States apologize for intruding into its territorial waters and promise never to do it again. And the United States resisted that, the government resisted that, because they had no evidence that the Pueblo had ever gone inside territorial waters of North Korea, and in fact it had not. And they weren't going to apologize for something that that they hadn't done. And that was the position within the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon. And they tried various gambits to get the North Koreans to release the crew. One of them was, the United States, will do an investigation, and if we find out that the ship did anything wrong, we'll express our regrets. The North Koreans didn't want to do that. Another idea was, we'll transfer the crew to a third nation, including a communist nation like the Soviet Union, an ally of North.
Oh, hey, Alvin. There we go. Yeah, Alvin, stay on the line. You there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay, all right. So here we go. We're getting down to that 11-month, and time is coming. You know you're going to be released. How did you feel when you heard the news?
Well, we never heard the news. We never knew he was going to be released till we got up to the bridge. We never knew, and then we were told we'd been so many falsified times taking us one place to another, we thought we was going home, and we kind of gave up. And the next thing you know, we're here at the bridge of no return, and we were told that we would get off in increments of 1 mile each at exactly the same distance, and we looked back, we would be shot. And that was the first knowledge that we really had that we were actually going home. And when we got home, it was so good. It was so sweet, you know. And we, every one of us have psychological problems, of course. And it was a rough time for me, especially in the 70s, when wasn't a lot of people really sympathized with you as much, you know. So anyway, it was a great thing being home. And I wanted to say to Jack, too, that you did a good job on that book. That's the reason I called. I didn't think I was going to do any speaking necessarily, but just wanted to tell you did a good job on your book. And
you know,
and
Alvin,
you know, listening.
You did beautiful. Man, you did beautiful. And we want to thank you very much for being on the program. Please listen again, Alvin.
Yes, I will.
And God bless you, and God bless all your fellow sailors that were with you, those that are still alive in that, those that have departed.
Well, I'd like to say that in September here in Pueblo, I live in Colorado, and we're in Pueblo, we're having our 45th reunion.
When's that going to be?
That'll be in the middle of September.
Okay. Well, don't forget to let us know. Thank you very much, Alvin.
Yep.
Okay, back, Jack. Yeah, all right, the Gremlins. So we've only got about a minute and a half. Here we are, wrap it up. By the way, folks, you can buy the book. If you want all the details, go to our bookstore on our website, veteransradio.net, www, all that other business. Go to the bookstore. The book's available. Buy it through Veterans Radio's call. Act of War, Jack Cheevers. Jack, we got about 30 seconds. Real quick, what would you like to say?
Well, I want to thank you, first of all, Bob, and Dale as well. And it was really fascinating to have Alvin call up and to get this information from the horse's mouth.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we'll have you back on. Let's do this again, maybe around the summertime when they're going to have that reunion. Jack, thank you very much for being on the program. We look forward to talking with you again.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Wow, Dale. Oh, Lord. 40 seconds, here we are. Man, there's just never enough time, huh? Huh?
Never.
Never.
Never,
never
enough time.
Never, never. What an exciting, exciting story and book, well written. I couldn't put it down. Act of War, Jack Cheevers, the author. Go to the website on veteransradio.net. click on book. Uh-oh, there it is. There's the Musica. Musica. And there we are, 13, 10, 11. Dale and I will be back next week. We're going to be, well, we're going to kind of make it a surprise. Until that time, you are dismissed.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or Ave Maria Radio. Veterans Radio Today was produced by Bob Gould.